Somewhere to run. Can we go back in time to where we've been? To when I felt you on my skin. On my skin. Am I lost or are we all? I feel so small. Is there something more or nothing at all? Is anyone out there? Can anyone hear me? Just let me know. Is anyone out there? Can anyone hear me? Just let me know. We can't be lonely together.
Thank you. DePose from The Faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
We have to start today with something so important and of such consequence, but which regularly generates almost no interest from our audience, which is foreign policy and what's going on right now with Russia and Ukraine. As we've been covering, and as many of you have been seeing on a variety of different media outlets, Russia has been massing troops at the border with Ukraine. Now, even that statement is questioned by some who want to defend Putin or claim that that's all a lie for the purposes of furthering American imperialism or whatever. We're going to have a real hard time having any conversation if we can't even agree on the fundamentals. But that's going on. And now the discussion is among the United States as well as other NATO allies about if, when, and how to mobilize military resources to NATO allies surrounding Ukraine, remembering that Ukraine is not part of NATO, and that's a piece of this as well, with the question of what would happen with those troops if indeed Russia did push into Ukraine, and what would be Russia's reason for doing so, and does Vladimir Putin really plan to do that, or is he only making it appear as though he might plan to do that? So the latest news is that the Pentagon has put 8,500 troops on what they are calling heightened alert, and that Joe Biden was presented with a number of options, including moving troops and equipment from other parts of Europe into Poland, Romania, and other neighboring countries to Ukraine. Again, remembering that Ukraine itself is not a NATO ally. The U.S. is discussing the deployment of military forces to Eastern Europe with NATO allies. Lloyd Austin has placed 8,500 troops on heightened alert to assist with the defense of NATO allies. We have a clip of that. Here is John Kirby, the spokesperson from the Pentagon.
I want to provide some facts on these preparations that will reinforce our commitment to NATO and to the NATO response force and increase our readiness. Secretary Austin has placed a range of units in the United States on a heightened preparedness to deploy, which increases our readiness to provide forces if NATO should activate the NRF or if other situations develop. All told, the number of forces that the secretary has placed on heightened alert comes up to about 8,500 personnel.
So we don't know what's going to happen yet. There are all sorts of different speculations, which quite frankly aren't super interesting to me because we just don't know what Vladimir Putin is thinking. But one of the most interesting aspects of this is how different political factions in the U.S. have responded. As many of you now probably know, on the Trump right, there is indeed a pro-Putin, pro-Russia wing, which developed under Trump. And it came in part from Trump's sort of deference to Vladimir Putin, for lack of a better term. Not saying Putin is a puppet master of Trump in any direct way. I'm not saying they colluded together to figure. You don't have to believe any of that stuff. That's not what I'm saying. Trump has been enamored with strongman authoritarian dictator types. He talked about how he and Kim Jong-un fell in love. I might even have that clip. We fell in love.
And then we fell in love.
Exactly. Okay. You guys know all this stuff. And to that end, we have seen a lot of these Trumpists kind of become enamored similarly with Putin and Russia. Similarly, there are some on the left, what I tend to call, here we go, the revolutionary left, the Stalinist Leninist left. And that's L-E-N-I-N, by the way. Some of you write to me and spell Lenin like John Lennon. And I'm wondering, like, who do they think I'm referring to when I say Leninist? Anyway, there's some there as well who have become very deferential to Russia. Usually they are sort of pro Chavez Maduro types. Often they like Fidel Castro. Sometimes their views on Syria are sort of strange. So there's that group as well. But one of the really interesting things is that there's kind of a factual firewall that seems to be plaguing some, where yesterday I saw, for example, why is it that Tucker saying we should be loyal to Russia is not okay, but Democrats saying we should be loyal to Ukraine is okay. Like, either way, you're just kind of picking a side. And of course, I'm not picking any sides. I'm against aggression and I'm against strongman authoritarians. In this particular case, it's Putin massing the troops at the border with Ukraine. It is not Ukraine massing troops at the border with Russia and throwing signals as if they might invade Russia. So you can have any analysis that makes sense to you. You can have a particular predilection for Russia or Ukraine. And quite frankly, I don't. But to say it's sort of the same when one side clearly is the one at least feigning aggression, if not actually planning to carry it out, is not a very sensible analysis. So now there's going to be some wait and see. And if anybody is going to write in and say, David, you imperialist bastard wanting U.S., I don't want any aggression. I don't want any invasion. I don't want any war. I don't want troop deployment. I don't want any of it. I think it's all bad. And I'm selfishly of that opinion. I want stable economies. What's happening in the stock market almost daily is not pleasing to me. And I think it would only get worse if these escalations rose. So I'm against all of it. I don't want the U.S. invading anybody or anything like that. Now, once you understand the dynamics of Ukraine not even being in NATO and the discussion with Biden and NATO allies is about the defense of NATO allies in the area, you understand that that conversation isn't even the appropriate one to be having. But that's what's going on. We may know more within a day. We may know more within weeks, could be months. We just don't know. Major legal news out of the state of Georgia. A grand jury has been approved to investigate Donald Trump's election interference. Remember those 11,000 votes he wanted?
I need 11,000 votes. Give me a break.
Yeah. It turns out crimes may have been committed there, and we may soon see the difference in power between a congressional subpoena and your regular, good old-fashioned district court grand jury subpoena. CNN reporting, DA for Atlanta area granted special grand jury to probe Trump's election interference. This is not good news for the former president. The article reads, an Atlanta area district attorney investigating former President Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 results in Georgia will be allowed to seat a special grand jury this spring. Fulton County DA Fannie Willis requested last week to seat a special grand jury starting May 2nd. Some are saying that's an ambitious date, but we'll see. Fulton County Superior Court judges approved the request on Monday. Though the special grand jury does not have the authority to issue an indictment, the move will allow Willis to seat a panel exclusively focused on gathering evidence in the Trump investigation. She said she needed such a grand jury in order to issue subpoenas to compel witnesses to testify and gather evidence, a step toward pursuing possible criminal charges. Understand, this is all under the umbrella of criminality. Willis said she expects to decide whether to bring charges against Trump in the first half of 2022, which gives us that self-imposed deadline is June 30th. Now, can you do that between May 2nd and June 30th? You can. Legal analyses I've read say you can, but it is certainly aggressive. Willis wrote last week that her office received information indicating a reasonable probability that the state of Georgia's administration of elections in 2020, including the state's election of president of the U.S., was subject to possible criminal disruptions. This is very, very real and very, very serious. This is going to give the DA, Fannie Willis, the power to file criminal subpoenas. These are much more difficult to delay or to avoid than the congressional subpoenas that we've been seeing under the umbrella of the Trump riot investigation. As far as she believes, she has enough materials to suggest crimes were committed. And in theory, at least, depending on if and what Donald Trump comes up with, if the situation surfaces, she could compel testimony to the grand jury to further the belief that criminality took place. Now, grand juries in Georgia have some interesting rules. The accused in Georgia does not have a right to appear before a grand jury. They don't have a right to have their attorney appear before a grand jury. They don't have the right to present witnesses or cross-examine witnesses. If you are accused and a grand jury is investigating you in Georgia, you are not, it is not a criminal trial with all of the rights that come as a defendant in a criminal trial. You can testify or refuse to testify in accordance with a Fifth Amendment invocation. And the U.S. judicial system considers lying to a grand jury very, very serious. And this is very quickly having the potential to become a serious criminal matter for Donald Trump. Now, let's talk about the timeline a little bit. Like I said, May 2nd is when the grand jury is expected or planned to be impaneled. And they are saying they want to make decisions about whether or not to charge Donald Trump criminally. If that is indeed the person that becomes the focus by the during the first half of the year, which is June 30th. So you're basically talking about 2 months. Can a grand jury really do everything it needs to do to allow the DA to make a charging decision in just 2 months? Again, in reading opinions from legal analysts on this, it is possible, but there are legal and analysts who believe it is far more likely that the charging decision would come closer to the November elections. Now, I'm not even imagining what the repercussions of that may be, because there's still a lot of things that have to happen between now and then. But this is step one. Step one is you get the go ahead for the grand jury. You start sending out subpoenas. You see who shows up and then you go from there. So might not be disastrous for Donald Trump. He does seem to be quite Teflon when it comes to anything that looks at him personally. But if you're Trump, you would have preferred the grand jury be rejected rather than approved. And that's where we are right now. It has been approved. Let me know what, if anything, you believe will come from this. You can find me on Twitter at @dpacman. Send me your thoughts. We'll take a very quick break and be right back. As an independently run progressive media show, we do depend on people from our audience to support the work that we do. And the easiest way to do that, the quickest way to do that, and the most direct, where the vast majority of every dollar stays with us, is to get a membership at joinpacman.com. We do an extra show every day for our members. You also get commercial-free audio and video feeds of the show. And you get the show every day 6 hours earlier than we release it publicly. 6 hours earlier. That's a big deal. You can sign up at joinpacman.com. You can also use the coupon code WOW22 to save off of the price of a membership, if you so please. Pay full price or not. We just want as many people involved and supporting as possible. And you can sign up at joinpacman.com. All right. Let's talk about something very, very disturbing. Not that Joe Biden called a reporter a son of a bitch. We'll get to that. But I'm finding that to be in poor taste, but not actually scary and disturbing. The following is scary and disturbing. Republicans are now openly saying, if they win the House of Representatives in November and take control in January of 2023, they will look to subpoena, potentially prosecute, and maybe imprison members of Congress participating in the January 6th committee investigating the Trump riots of last year. When they say this stuff, we should take them seriously rather than saying, no. When they told us what they were planning for the 2020 presidential, they did it. We should have taken it more seriously, and we should be taking this more seriously now. So I'm going to play a clip for you of Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich was the Speaker of the House in 1994, ushered in significant acceleration in the Republican Party's abandonment of policy and moving into cultural issues and the like. We've talked about his role in that significantly. You can check out my interview with Noam Chomsky, where we talk about Newt Gingrich's role. One of the things that we have heard from Republicans is that if they win the House in 2022, they will impeach Joe Biden. And I believe that they certainly will try. But here is something extraordinarily dystopian from Newt Gingrich. And again, just we have no reason to doubt him. Here he is.
You're going to have a Republican majority in the House and a Republican majority in the Senate. And all these people who've been so tough and so mean and so nasty are going to be delivered subpoenas for every document, every conversation, every tweet, every email, because I think it's clear that these are people who are literally just running over the law, pursuing innocent people, causing them to spend thousands and thousands of dollars in legal fees for no justification. And it's basically a lynch mob. And unfortunately, the Attorney General of the United States has joined that lynch mob and is totally misusing the FBI. And I think when you have a Republican Congress, this is all going to come crashing down, and the wolves are going to find out that they're now sheep, and they're the ones who are, in fact, going to, I think, face a real risk of jail for the kind of laws they're breaking.
Participating in the duly empaneled investigation of one of the most disgusting events of the last 5 years in the United States. If Newt Gingrich got his way, and he's not running, but he's still a powerful figure in the Republican Party, might put some of those investigators in jail. Folks, when they tell you what they're going to do or what they're going to try to do, take them seriously. That is a lesson from the 2020 presidential election. Take them seriously. Even Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney issued a warning over this. She retweeted the Gingrich video we just played and added the comment, quote, "A former Speaker of the House is threatening jail time for members of Congress who are investigating the violent January 6th attack on our Capitol and our Constitution." This is what it looks like when the rule of law unravels. Now, Liz Cheney is one of only two Republicans on that committee doing the investigation, so she may feel as though she is now in the crosshairs and may have a personal interest in this for sure. But this is an idea that Republicans are liking. Here is video of Matt Gaetz appearing on Real America's Voice War Room. This might even be his show. I'm so confused by this channel. This may be Matt Gaetz's own show. Listen to what he had to say about it.
Now you have the January 6th event, where I expect that there will be these shadowy, gray area, national security types that are in and around the activation of the increase in criminal acuity of that day. And not for nothing, Steve, but using a cutout seems like exactly what they were trying to do to me.
Now, note, this is all conspiratorial type stuff about the people doing the investigating or the ones responsible for the riot. It's crazy. But let's continue to listen, because it tells us what his state of mind is when it comes to this stuff.
There's a guy named Steve Alford who's sitting in prison right now for trying to extort me, but he was not acting alone. Very likely, he was answering to a cutout, someone like Bob Kent, to try to destroy me, because you know what? Newt's right. We are going to take power. And when we do, it's not going to be the days of Paul Ryan and Trey Gowdy where the Republicans go limp-wristed, where they lose their backbone and fail to send a single subpoena.
Limp-wristed, is that a homophobic phrase? I'm not super familiar with it, but it strikes me as potentially homophobic. Let me know.
No, it's going to be the days of Jim Jordan and Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Taylor Greene. And you know what? We're going to get answers, real answers about what happened in the election, answers about the Wuhan Institute of Virology, and certainly answers about a Department of Justice and a national security apparatus that has gone totally off the rails. They have become the enforcement wing of the Democratic Party. The entire country knows it. And you know what? We need honest, fair, real application of the laws in our country.
Yes.
We're not getting that now. And frankly, we weren't really getting it at the DOJ under President Trump.
So listen, you've got to take them seriously. Just believe what they're telling you. If they're telling you they're going to do this stuff, then we have to listen and we have to take it seriously, because they seem to really try to do it. Whether they get away with it is a different question. You know, they tried the 2020 stuff. When you look back and think about 2020, they tried every aspect of it. They tried the fake elector stuff. They tried pressuring local officials. They tried stopping the count versus starting the count as convenient to them. At least it was in the conversation about declaring a national emergency / martial law, although they'll say they weren't really close to doing it, which may be true, but it was part of the discussion. We know that, multiple people have told us. They're telling us what they're going to do, and we have to take it really seriously. They will try to jail their political adversaries, and they're admitting that that's what they're going to try to do. And we've got to be really, really concerned about it and not let our guard down. And 2022 is particularly consequential because of that. This is a crazy story out of Australia. We have quite a few viewers in Australia. In fact, it's one of our outside of the U.S. I mean, it makes sense. It's a lot of English speaking countries. Canada, the U.K. and Australia are where we have some of the biggest audiences. And close to 10 people sent me this story about Australian anti-vaxxers completely fabricating the death of a boy from Sydney, Australia, supposedly from the COVID vaccine. It turns out it was completely made up. This is being reported by Seven News in Australia, as well as a number of other media outlets. A distraught Sydney father has shared how his beautiful 7-year-old boy died in the back of an ambulance days after being vaccinated against COVID. But authorities say it's a hoax. In a lengthy Facebook comment, Steve Leary claimed his son, Lachlan, received his first vaccine dose on Wednesday. Is that a popular Australian name? Because isn't one of Rupert Murdoch's kids also named Lachlan? Lachlan received his first dose on January 12th. Experienced a fever and difficulty breathing shortly after. He claims he took his son to West Med Hospital, where they ran tests and after 5 hours sent him home. Friday morning at 4 a.m., we heard him yell out. He was on his bedroom floor. He then collapsed. He was not breathing, wrote the father. He claims his son died of a massive heart attack and warns other parents not to vaccinate. The government has ruined my family. They have taken away our only son. I mean, this is tragic if true. The post quickly gathered pace online, collecting thousands of likes, comments and shares before the profile was taken down and the post reshared as a screenshot. But it's believed to be the latest case of misinformation running rife, a deliberate attempt to discourage parents booking in to get their children vaccinated, less than a week after 5 to 11-year-olds became eligible for COVID vaccines in Australia. There is no record of a Lachlan Leary who died in Sydney last week, or indeed at all. NSW Health told Seven News it, quote, has not been able to locate any record of such incident. And the Therapeutic Goods Administration, which collates all adverse events associated with vaccines, also rubbished the claim. In a statement, a spokesperson stressed it has not received any adverse event reports involving the death of any children between 5 and 11. The Children's Hospital at Westmead also refuted the reports in writing, saying there are many inaccurate posts currently circulating on social media. There is no record of any child having passed away following COVID vaccination at our hospital. There are also questions surrounding the validity of Mr. Leary's profile. News of the death pictured Leary, a man who lives in the United States and served as the mayor of Winter Park, a small town in Florida. This is really immoral. And everything we believe now indicates that this is merely a hoax meant to dissuade parents from going and getting their kids vaccinated against COVID. We are fortunately seeing the decline of Omicron now in the United States. Cases down about 21% as of this morning. We are seeing a leveling out globally. Many individual states in the U.S. are down significantly. But one of the groups that is most getting seriously ill on a rate basis is the very young, most of whom have not yet been vaccinated. And this is, again, it's another opportunity to move to the endemic phase. Endemic doesn't mean no risk, but it means something different than pandemic. We have an opportunity. Part of it is getting as many people protected from getting seriously ill. You might catch it, but you're much less likely to be seriously ill. 5 to 11-year-olds are part of that. And this appears to be an out and out complete and total hoax. And I hope that, at least as far as the U.S. is concerned, this reminds people, when you hear about Vayer's reports, where tens of thousands of reports about kids dead from the vaccine, those reports are completely unverified. Anybody can go and submit a report to Vayer's. Now, people will write in, they'll say, David, it's a crime to do that. Is anybody getting prosecuted for that? Have you heard of anybody being prosecuted for submitting a false report to Vaers? That is not dissuading people from doing it. They are weaponizing the Vaers report, which is the vaccine adverse effects reporting system. I assume the S is system. So an incredibly pernicious moment. And I am not advocating one way or the other. Australia has different laws than the United States. It remains to be seen whether this individual may face some kind of penalty. Of course, if he really lives in the United States, it's not really clear that anything would apply. But we're going to follow the story. That's everything we know right now. And we will have a link to the story and more information on our Instagram, which you can find at David Pakman Show. Today, we're going to be speaking with David Feidler, who's a writer, philosopher, and also author of the recently published book, Breakfast with Seneca, A Stoic Guide to the Art of Living, which is a clear and accurate guide to the teachings of the Stoic philosopher Seneca. David, it's really great having you on. I appreciate it.
Hey, it's great to speak with you, David.
So particularly during the pandemic, on social media and elsewhere, Stoicism as a philosophy has become very, very much en vogue, with a lot of different people posting everything from memes to articles about it. And often there's this kind of very top level understanding that Stoicism means showing little emotion and just sort of being only slightly connected to the world around you, which is not at all what the philosophy advocates for. So maybe we could start there. With what is Stoicism?
Right, that's a really good starting point. And Stoicism, it's an ancient Greek and Roman philosophy of life. But the issue that you're alluding to is the word Stoic has actually changed to mean something totally else over the course of like many centuries. The philosophy itself is like 2,300 years old, and now Stoicism means to repress your emotions or keep a stiff upper lip. And that has nothing to do with the original philosophy. In fact, the Stoics were not unemotional in any way. They experienced regular emotions and they thought they were fine. The only problem that the Stoics had was with extreme negative emotions, which they felt arose from incorrect opinions, and they saw those extreme negative emotions as being things like anger, worry, anxiety, and things like that.
So how did someone like Seneca, what framework did Seneca advocate for dealing with those negative emotions?
Okay. One of the most central teachings of Stoicism, this is something that all of the Roman Stoics believed in, and this is probably a huge takeaway for the people who are listening to this discussion today, is that their idea was that we can't control what actually happens to us, but we can control how we respond to things. They all believed in that. And the main idea was that it's not really things or events that upset us, but the opinions or judgments that we hold about things. And an example of this that I use in the book is imagine it's like raining and you're walking along one day and you walk by a big puddle and a car comes by and splashes you and you're covered with water. Well, someone might have the mental opinion that, well, I just got splashed, which is a pretty objective way of looking at things. But another person might think, oh, you've ruined my entire day, and then develop a sense of anger and rage about that, and then want to get even with the driver in some way. So that shows how the opinions that we hold about things really influence our emotional states, or even act as the seed of these extreme negative emotions. And this belief, it's not things or events that upset us, but the opinions we hold about things. That's the origin of what is now known as cognitive therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy. And the Stoics really invented cognitive therapy. That's what their theory of emotion was about. And the modern people, the modern psychologists who invented cognitive therapy, actually drew on these Stoic ideas and mentioned the Stoics by name.
Yeah, you know, as I hear you talk about it, there's this book from the 20th century by Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning, which I don't think is overtly about Stoicism, but he lays out in the context of surviving the Holocaust a very similar idea about he could not control his circumstances, but he could control the reaction he had to those circumstances, which seems quite similar.
Exactly. And I think there's a very famous saying attributed to him that our freedom exists in the fact that we're able to pause before we make a decision or a judgment. And that's really our source of freedom. Now, apparently, he didn't say that. It went back to Rollo May. But the thought is the same. And certainly his idea, you know, is an exact parallel to that of the Stoics.
One of the kind of big pushbacks and reactions I see to this recent popularization of Stoicism are comments along the lines of, yeah, that's really great to think about if your basic needs are met and you have time to hang out on social media or reading books. But if you're not sure where your next meal is coming from, or you don't have housing, or you need health care and can't afford it, Stoicism is not useful in that way. And it's another one of these sort of now becoming commercialized ideas that spread on social media. How would you react to that critique of the popularization of Stoicism?
I don't think that's really true, because now, Seneca actually was very wealthy. The person, the Stoic philosopher I wrote the book about, he was actually one of the wealthiest people in the Roman Empire. But the earlier Greek Stoics weren't wealthy at all. And the most famous Stoic to follow him in Rome was Epictetus. So Epictetus was maybe like about 15 when Seneca died. And he was actually a slave. So it was a philosophy that was embraced from slaves to Roman emperors. And certainly all of these Stoic ideas are applicable, you know, by anyone today. It doesn't matter on your level of wealth. In fact, the Stoics believed that our true goods lie within us. And they believed that, you know, it's very valuable and it's an advantage to have like wealth, a beautiful family, a beautiful house. But it's only our inner character that allows us to use those things in a good way. So for the Stoics, the most important part of life was really developing a good character. And that's something they would say holds true for everyone.
With, if I recall correctly, Seneca had some views on crowds and mob mentality that seem like they might be relevant today to some degree, including to media and sort of some of the other modern things that humans today are presented with. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Seneca has this story about how he went to see the gladiatorial games, and then people were being killed in front of his eyes, and the crowd was cheering for the death of the gladiators and the other people that were thrown into the ring. And he was actually, as far as I can tell, the first person to write about what is now called a crowd or mob psychology, which was a study that developed in like the mid-1800s. And people now study things like emotional contagions, things like that, and also how we unconsciously assimilate the behavior of people that we're exposed to. And this holds very true in today's sort of like internet world or Twitter world, where you know, you get these emotional contagions that seem to float through the internet. And they're very contagious, because sometimes you'll see like a video clip and you don't have the full context of it, and people are making judgments about it and denouncing it and things like that. And it's very easy to get swept up in that kind of behavior. And Seneca warned about that specifically. If he was alive today, he would say, you know, take a step back and don't assent you know, immediately to the judgment of the crowd or the mob, but wait until things become clarified, and also, you know, be mindful of due process as well. You can't make those judgments just based on a tweet. Oftentimes, usually you need further information.
What was you write in the book about the value of time and of not postponing what one wants to do sort of indefinitely, or I mean, maybe even to any degree beyond what's kind of logistically necessary. Can you talk a little bit about that and the connection to Stoicism?
Right. Well, this is something that's really specific to Seneca. He writes about this a lot, and he says that time is our most valuable asset. So people are very careful about the way that they guard their wealth, but when it comes to guarding their time, they don't even think about it, usually. And his idea is that people spend a lot of time rushing around and acting as though they're preoccupied with things, whereas it's more of an act sometimes. And he felt that we should be very careful about the way that we use our time. What I would say, he actually talks about, for example, like how people believe that they'll someday retire and they spend their entire life working. But then he says, how do you know that you'll live to be 50 or 60 years old? You could die any moment. And his idea was like finding some kind of balance between work and leisure. And he would have agreed with the modern idea that we should work to live rather than live to work.
Yeah, that's, you know, sometimes you get these distortions, I guess I would say, of some of these precepts, and they are sort of exaggerated and taken to the extreme, where like what you just said would be taken to mean, you know, this kind of you only live once, don't plan for the future at all kind of mentality. But really, it seems to me the value in thinking about these things is about finding some kind of balance that makes sense rather than picking some extreme to adhere to.
Exactly. And that's something that everyone really has to deal with on their own, because everyone's life is different. So how one person will find the kind of balance between life and work will be different than another person. But it's certainly an important question to think about.
Going back a little bit to the social contagion thing, which, you know, you explained and I think is really clear when it comes to like stuff on the internet, as an example, when you look at the socio-political system, maybe specifically in the United States, what are some other areas in which this social contagion is taking place that would be interesting to be aware of?
Well, I think actually one of the reasons that this has become such a phenomenon is it's exacerbated by the internet. And another aspect of it also is that the internet has been very good for many things. For example, we can have discussions like this. But in other ways, I think it's been very, very negative, because people base journalistic coverage now on the number of clicks that stories get. So journalism has become very clickbaity. And it's also really harmed, you know, serious print journalism. So basically, journalists and the media have every reason to encourage people getting angry about things, for example, because, you know, it's those stories that make people angry that usually have the highest, you know, click-through rates.
Yeah, and we see that daily, where a story that we spend a while researching about, to take today, you know, the buildup to what's going on with Russia and Ukraine,
right,
it just is not going to generate even a fraction of the interest that Joe Biden calling that Fox reporter a son of a bitch yesterday is going to generate. And if you ask me which is most substantively valuable, it's obviously the geopolitical impact with historical implications of the Ukraine-Russia thing. But it's not it for all the reasons you're talking about, it's just not going to do as well.
Right. You know, another thing, too, is that you have these huge media platforms now. And so they have a certain amount of space allotted for, you know, the so-called news, so that if nothing's happening, they actually have to fill it with something.
Yes. Yeah, no, that's certainly an issue as well. When it comes to Marcus Aurelius is often sort of, your book focuses on Seneca, but you mentioned Seneca, Epictetus, Marcus Aurelius, kind of the third in the maybe most three known Stoics. does his perspective, did his perspective differ in significant ways from that of Seneca?
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting because when I was researching the book, I looked into this in a great deal of depth, and it's surprising how similar the views of the three main Roman Stoics were. For example, an average reader wouldn't notice this, but all three of the Roman Stoics believed that when you were on your deathbed, that you should feel a sense of gratitude when you're dying for the gift of life that the universe has given to you.
Mm.
And I find that to be amazing. And that for them would be a mark of a life that was well lived. And that was the whole point of philosophy, is to live a life that's truly worth living. So if you felt a deep sense of regret on your deathbed, that would probably mean that you felt that you had made some very serious errors in your life. Another idea that I think is very important for people today, that comes from the Stoics. All of the Stoics believed in this. They were the most pro-social philosophers in the ancient world, and they taught that we should all contribute to society. Marcus Aurelius was obsessed with this. His Meditations is a pretty short book, but he reminds himself, like it was his personal notebook, he reminds himself 80 times to contribute to the common good. And the Stoics, they didn't believe these things in the way that a religious person would believe them, because they were philosophers, so they always had an argument for this. And their argument was that all people are born with the faculty of reason, which makes us rational creatures. And it also makes us equal to one another. So the Stoics were the first philosophical school to say that human beings were equal to one another, the idea of human equality. And it also means that because we have this spark of reason in common, there's a universal brotherhood or sisterhood of humanity that we're all part of. And that means we should help each other. And over the course of centuries, it took a very long time, this Stoic idea led to the idea of human rights, equality, and ultimately to the elimination of slavery in some ways, because the Enlightenment philosophers who were talking about human rights and criticizing the institution of slavery were very familiar with these Stoic views and drew upon them.
Incredible historical context. And some of what we've been talking about today is in the book Breakfast with Seneca, A Stoic Guide to the Art of Living. We've been speaking with the book's author, writer, and philosopher David Feidler. Really appreciate your time today and your insights.
Great. It's been wonderful speaking with you.
I don't know how many of you are old enough to remember Sarah Palin. Sarah Palin used to be the governor of Wasilla, Alaska. She was John McCain's presidential running mate in 2008. Had John McCain won, Sarah Palin would have been a heartbeat away from the presidency, which is a very scary thought because she is aggressively incompetent. Could have been maybe, I don't even think it's even close, would have been dramatically less competent than even someone like a Dan Quayle. So we really dodged a bullet in terms of Sarah Palin not becoming the vice president of the United States. Sarah Palin recently said she will get a COVID vaccine over her dead body, meaning she'll die before she gets a COVID vaccine. Sarah Palin now has COVID. And it is, of course, raising a lot of questions as to whether what the course of the disease is going to be. Reuters reporting Sarah Palin's positive COVID test delays her New York Times defamation trial, which is also just hilarious. Sarah Palin has tested positive for the virus, forcing a U.S. judge to delay her defamation trial against the New York Times. It's particularly funny that her bogus defamation trial now gets delayed because she has COVID. Jury selection was expected to start Monday, pushed back 10 days after the test results for the 57-year-old Palin became known. She was expected to testify in person as soon as today, Tuesday. U.S. District Judge Jed Rakoff in Manhattan said she is, of course, unvaccinated. Since she has apparently tested positive three times, I'm going to assume she is positive. Palin also tested positive last March. She has objected to mandatory vaccinations. It will be over my dead body that I will have to get a shot. Here is the video of Sarah Palin explaining that to Turning Point USA's Charlie Kirk. Remember this?
And I will, it'll be over my dead body that I'll have to get a shot. I will not do it.
Right. crowd loves that.
I won't do it, and they better not touch my kids either, because that's where the...
Well, Governor, some people say, though, I might lose my job. I might get kicked out of school.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, I think if enough of us, though, rise up and say, no, enough is enough. There are more of us than there are of them.
Okay, anyway, so over her dead body, she will get vaccinated. Let's really hope it doesn't come to that. Now, there's a question as to whether she's really unvaccinated or is claiming she is to keep up appearances. Some people even saying, I will have to get a shot over my dead body, which may be different than I've gotten a shot by choice, but I won't get one by force. With all these people, it's like the DeSantis thing. Were you boosted, sir? Well, you know, I got the normal shot. Well, so hold on. Are you boosted or not? No, I'm not going to say that. Now, we could ask her, but the truth is that should really be between her and her doctor, because as you all know, all of these Republicans believe that medical decisions should be left to women and their doctors when it comes to women's health. Those are private matters in which the state should have. What? Oh, I'm sorry. Now I understand why it's so stupid to be saying that. So Sarah Palin has COVID and she, I guess, will get a shot only over her dead body. All right. This story is really interesting. So yesterday, Joe Biden called Fox News reporter Peter Ducey a stupid son of a bitch. Some people say it was a hot mic that Joe Biden didn't know his mic was on. It's not obvious to me. I when you watch the video, when you listen, Biden's face is right in front of a microphone. And I think it's quite plausible Biden did know that the mic was on and it sort of like slipped out or he just didn't care or whatever. And the incident itself is not that interesting to me, but the reaction is absolutely fascinating because of the incredible hypocrisy that Republicans are applying. So here's the backstory. Steve Ducey is in the press corps for Fox News. His big thing is constantly trying to ask gotcha questions of Jen Psaki and of Joe Biden. They're often very stupid, but it doesn't really matter. Joe Biden calls on Peter Ducey all the time. It's known. Everybody knows Ducey's going to ask adversarial questions. Joe Biden calls on him all the time. He hasn't tried to get him kicked out of the press corps. He hasn't tried to get his credential removed the way Donald Trump did of Jim Acosta and others. And so yesterday, as Peter Ducey often does, he yelled a question to Joe Biden. The question was, is it a liability to have high inflation? And Biden sort of responded, no, it's an asset, sarcastically, and said, you stupid son of a bitch. So here's the video and here's the audio.
It's a great asset. More inflation. What a stupid son of a bitch.
Okay. What a stupid son of a bitch. So let's go through this. Is Ducey, we're going to get to Glenn Greenwald in a second. Is Ducey more or less a moron? Yeah. His you know, bogus gotcha questions. They're just so boring at this point. They're gotchas, but they fail. Now, Joe Biden was out of line when it comes to decorum. This is not how a president should speak to members of the press. I agree with the assessment of Ducey as basically being a moron. He's annoying. He's just trying to get gotchas and sound bites and whatever. But when I would criticize Donald Trump and say that's not how you should be treating members of the press, I apply the exact same standard to Joe Biden. Biden was out of line. Presidents shouldn't speak like this, even if it was funny, even if it was fun, even if it was a higher energy moment for Biden, whatever. OK, so fine. It should not have spoken that way. That being said, there are people taking this incident to suggest that the sky is falling and that this is a dangerous attack on press freedom. One example is a guy named Glenn Greenwald. Greenwald used to do some pretty good reporting back in the day, did a lot of interesting stuff. But now, I don't know what is going on with Glenn Greenwald. Check out, this is a very somber Greenwald reporting to us that it is a very dark, dark day in America because of what Joe Biden said. Check this out.
Hello, everyone. This is Glenn Greenwald. And today is a dark and really dangerous day for press freedom in America. A hardworking journalist, Peter Ducey, did nothing more than go to work today to do his job. He went to the White House to ask a question of the most powerful political official on the planet, President Biden, a question. And this is the assault that was unleashed on him.
Okay, so then he plays it. It was an assault. This is some of the fakest drama that I can imagine. Here's the bottom line, okay? Biden was out of line with Peter Ducey, without a doubt. The people saying this was a dangerous attack on freedom of the press, that this was an assault, when there has been no contempt for the media from Joe Biden during his presidency, these very same people, I'm not talking about Greenwald now, but just the people, look at Twitter, right? The very same people losing their minds over what Joe Biden said were silent during the Trump administration. When Trump mocked a disabled reporter, they were silent. When Trump attacked Jim Acosta and had him banned, and when he called Chuck Todd a bitch and all these different things, Biden was out of line. But Biden called Ducey to apologize. Trump never apologized to the reporters he mistreated. Look at how Peter Ducey even describes the conversation.
After years of clips of the president and I kind of mixing it up on the campaign trail and during the transition and here at the White House, within about an hour of that exchange, he called my cell phone and he said, "It's nothing personal, pal." And we went back and forth and we were talking about just kind of moving forward. And I made sure to tell him that I'm always going to try to ask something different than what everybody else is asking.
Right.
And he said, "You've got to." And that's a quote from the president. So
does that sound like Donald Trump? Does that prove to us that this was a dark and dangerous day in America? No, come on, guys. Biden immediately apologized. Trump would never apologize. Biden has never advocated for, nor has he tried to ban Peter Ducey from the press briefings. In fact, he calls on him almost every briefing. Trump took away Jim Acosta's press credential. Joe Biden has never broadly called adversarial media the enemy of the people. He's never called the media the enemy of the people. Trump called the enemy of, referred to adversarial media as the enemy of the people. There is no similarity between this and Trump. Biden was out of line. I apply the same standard to Biden and Trump on how they talk to members of the media. Biden apologized, and everything about the context is completely different. Give me a break, guys. It's hard to even take seriously the videos like that from Glenn Greenwald when what the relationship has been with the Biden administration and the media is 180 degrees different from what it was under Trump. If you disagree with me, let me know. But it's just pathetic opportunism that we are seeing here. We have a voicemail number. That number is 219-2-DAVID-P. Here is a voicemail from, again, someone who completely misunderstood everything I've said. I must really be a terrible communicator. Let's listen.
Whoa, David, I really feel bad for you right there when you describe the options that you're exploring. That last one with Poland and Belarus, that sounds like the long shot of the three. How about, have you considered a fourth option? Maybe somewhere in Spain or Italy?
Oh, God.
Since you're fluent in Spanish. I know there's Spanish speakers in Italy. Why not Spain or Italy? Have you thought about that?
I never said that moving to Poland or Belarus is anywhere on my list. When someone said, "David, what's your escape plan if the U.S. becomes authoritarian?" I explained, because I was born in Argentina, I can go back to Argentina anytime. That's an option. I could go to Israel, and I believe it's within about a year I could get citizenship there. The third option I mentioned is because I have lineage to Poland, family that fled Poland before the Holocaust, there is a law which, if you can prove that lineage, you can get a European passport. Okay. I explained the part of Poland my family was from is now Belarus. So I'm not thinking of moving to Belarus or Poland. I was explaining that the documents I need might be in what is now Belarus, or they might be in what is now Poland. But the point would be just to get the European passport. And with that, I would have my pick. And yes, of course, I would probably end up either in Spain because I speak Spanish, in France. My French is good enough and I really like France. Sure, Italy. But I'm not thinking of moving to Poland. And certainly not thinking of moving to Belarus, which is not even I wouldn't even be able to because it's a totally, totally different thing. I hope I've been more clear today. We have a great bonus show for you today. Israeli data suggests a fourth COVID shot is unlikely for most people. Now, the important thing is a fourth one of the one we have. What about an Omicron shot? That's a different story. And we're going to talk about that on today's bonus show. Number two. The U.S. Supreme Court is going to be hearing a challenge to race-conscious college admissions. These are elements of affirmative action. We're going to talk about it. Big, big case. And lastly, it shouldn't surprise us, after Republicans all voted against Joe Biden's COVID stimulus, they took credit for getting people money. And after voting against Joe Biden and Democrats' infrastructure bill, they are now taking credit for that infrastructure bill. Predictable. All on today's bonus show. Sign up at joinpacman.com.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
WRCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT, the inside from way out.
Hey there, folks. glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz. Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
What we have seen over the last 2 years is really total collapse of global cooperation and solidarity, period. I think there's absolutely no reason why a continent of Africa should be lagging behind with having 7% of the population fully immunized. A continent of 1.2 billion people is totally unacceptable. It's not the world that the humanity that we want to project.
As new cases of the highly infectious Omicron variant continue to climb in under-vaccinated parts of the world, we'll speak to the head of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention about how vaccine inequity will prolong the pandemic everywhere and lead to even more variants of the coronavirus. Then, to gangsters of capitalism, Smedley Butler, the Marines, and the making and breaking of America's empire.
The book tells the story that most Americans don't know about the way that America rose to imperial power in the first decades of the 20th century. And it's a book about how those wars have been forgotten here, how they're remembered all over the world, and how our imperial dealings have a way of coming back home in the form of fascism and authoritarianism.
We'll speak to author Jonathan Katz about the makings of U.S. empire, an effort to buy banking and business leaders to topple Franklin Delano Roosevelt's government in 1934 in order to establish a fascist dictatorship. The book also looks at the parallels between the 1934 attempted coup and the January 6th Capitol insurrection. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden said Tuesday he would consider personal sanctions against Russian President Vladimir Putin amidst mounting tensions over Ukraine. Russia has ordered a series of military drills as the U.S. and NATO build up their military presence in the region, and the U.S. announced plans to ensure adequate fuel supplies to Europe in the event of a Russian embargo. Meanwhile, Ukrainian leadership is warning against spreading panic, saying no decisive moves towards an incursion have been made. Some 100,000 Russian troops have been massed near the Ukrainian border for weeks. Biden addressed the escalating situation at a news conference Tuesday.
There will be enormous consequences if he were to go in and invade, as he could, the entire country, or a lot less than that as well, for Russia, not only in terms of economic consequences and political consequences, but it will be enormous consequences worldwide. This would be the largest, if he were to move in with all those forces, would be the largest invasion since World War II. It would change the world.
The Intercept is reporting House Democrats are planning to fast-track a bill that would increase U.S. military aid to Ukraine by $500 million and provide military training to Ukrainian forces. This comes as political advisors from Russia, Ukraine, France, and Germany are holding talks today in Paris. Germany has been more restrained than some of its European neighbors in response to the crisis, opposing sending weapons to Ukraine and warning against harsh sanctions on Russia. At least 23 people on an Australian ship carrying aid to Tonga have tested positive for COVID-19. Planes have been used to unload supplies for the volcano-stricken island nation amidst fears of spreading the coronavirus. So far, only one confirmed case has been reported in Tonga since the start of the pandemic. Meanwhile, in Australia, health authorities approved the Novavax vaccine for adults amidst an ongoing surge. It's expected to roll out next month. New Zealand's imposed its toughest restrictions yet after at least 9 Omicron cases were detected. In South Korea, COVID cases hit a new daily record of 13,000.